Welcome to Roundtable Talk, a podcast about longevity, senior services marketing, and the quality of life as one ages. Roundtable Talk is brought to you by Pavone Group and Varsity, a senior services agency focused on helping clients win the mature market. If you like the fresh perspectives we deliver in each episode, please give Roundtable Talk a 5-star review on the podcast service of your choice.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Varsity's Roundtable Talk. Today's guest is Andrew Carl, a nationally recognized expert and one of the leading voices behind university retirement communities. As the founder of universityretirementcommunities.com, Andrew has been at the forefront of integrating lifelong learning with senior living. Andrew is also an adjunct professor at Georgetown University, where he developed and leads the graduate concentration in senior living administration within the Aging and Health Program. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
I want to jump right into the University Retirement Communities, or URCs. You've been a pioneer in this concept or in this movement. What sparked your interest?
Well, it goes back a ways, but 25 years ago, I had joined George Mason University to create what was then the first academic program for senior living administrators in the country. I'm a senior living executive. I'm not a PhD or researcher. I was an executive in residence there. But here I am working at this big university, and I found out that there were a couple of universities that had retirement communities. I hadn't heard of it, and I work in the field. So I actually got in the car with my wife and two kids one summer. I think we drove 3,000 miles, and I visited the ones that existed all the way out to Iowa, came back, and I realized when I got back that, oh my gosh, this could reinvent everything that we've been thinking about, and you and I can talk about that. But I very quickly settled into it around 2004 or 5. I created a 5-criteria model around which I thought they should be structured. I published that in 2006. And in the last 20 years or so, most of them have kind of been built to that model, which I think has really helped.
That's great. So can you walk us through how the concept of the University Retirement Communities has evolved since its early days?
You know, it's interesting because it's really gone from organic to kind of structured. And by the way, organic is always something you should pay attention to. You know, I'm an old director of strategic planning, and I actually taught those courses at Mason for 15 years. And you're always looking for people who naturally gravitate to things. And what I saw back then was a couple of universities, so Meadowood at Indiana University, where the president of the university wanted to retire but didn't want to leave, and basically took a piece of land across the street. It's supposed to be a $1 a year lease. I'm not even sure they paid the dollar. But they built some little cottage homes for him and some of his faculty members who also didn't want to leave. And for a few years, they had a lot of fun, and they had a little country club. And, you know, but then at some point, the wheelchairs and walkers started showing up. The Alzheimer's started showing up, and they realized, oh, my gosh, ran over our heads. But this was all organic, right? And there were a few of those like that. And so they had to learn on the fly, bring in senior living providers. Meadowood today is actually run by 5-Star Senior Living, a terrific community, done a great job with them for many years. I actually certified them for J.D. Power several years ago. Great community, but it was organic. Now, what we're seeing today is there's enough of them where, like any new product, they evolve and begin to form a structure. My 5-criteria model, frankly, was intended to help expedite that, and I think in many ways has. But to really look, if you want to do this, do it right. They're very complicated. And so we've been moving forward with that.
That's fascinating. Now, you know, we've talked a bit from our earlier conversations that Lindsay Beagley from Mirabella at Arizona State has been on the podcast. She's joined our roundtables. I really admire the work that she's doing. Are there specific universities that have been especially successful in the space? And what makes a university a good candidate for a university retirement community?
First of all, Lindsay's great. Know her very well. And what she did and what was critical about Lindsay is this, you know, she has a full-time dedicated role to this. One of the things I have said to, and I consult with a lot of schools on this, is, look, this is hard and it's complicated. You just can't dump this on somebody who's got some other job to do or the activities director or whatever. Mirabella put Lindsay in place. I like to call it a dean of residence. Her title is something else. But I mean, I look at these people as dean of residence. That's a person who does nothing all day, every day, but coordinate these relationships. And she has done just a textbook job of that. More people should emulate that. But the ones that have been successful, LaSalle Village up in near Boston, you know, they'll have a full-time person to do this. And they really work hard on keeping these connections, advancing them, looking for things to do.
Interesting. Now, do you see more private or public universities, you know, broadly embracing the model?
More public only because there's more public. But I mean, I think some privates, look, Stanford has one. You know, it just depends on, frankly, if they're paying attention to what's going on, reading the tea leaves, if they have land. You know, some of the problems with these really old private schools, Harvard or Yale, or, I mean, they haven't had a postage stamp piece of land, size piece of land for 150 years to do anything with. But it just really comes down to, do they see the opportunity? Do they have a good location? Are they committed to doing this right?
Sure. And what are some of the key elements to do it right that make them truly successful? Are there must-haves that differentiate a great university retirement community from a mediocre one?
Yeah, I mean, I think the five criteria that I put in, again, so here I am, I'm a senior living executive. You know, I was a COO of one of the top 10 largest companies. I was a founding executive and vice president with another top 10 company. I literally teach the courses in how to run these. So I looked at it from the operational side, but I also spent 15 years at a university. And so I looked at what are the elements that you need to bring together. And when I visited these around the country, kind of cherry picking, well, they got that right, but they missed this. They got that right, they missed this. And the five criteria really kind of coalesced and said, look, there's no exact model, but if you foundationally do this, if you are proximate to the university, number one. Number two, do you formalize programming between the community and the university, the students and the residents, i.e. like a dean of residence, do you have that in place so it's not just haphazard? Do you offer the full continuum of care? Because Senior Housing News did a survey on these a few years ago. 91% of these folks who are interested in a university retirement community don't expect to leave ever. I mean, think about it. They've been wearing the sweatshirt for 50 years. So they're not, they're the retired college president. So the full continuum of care is never more applicable than it is in these settings. And then looking at the financial commitment, not that the university should own it, but is there, are both sides financially incentivized for the long-term success? That could be a land lease. That could be contract medical staff from the medical school. But both parties have to have an interest in keeping this place going, right? And then the fifth element really was about the culture and saying, look, you need to have at least 10% of the residents who have some connection with the school. Doesn't have to be, you know, 100%. But I mean, if one out of every 10 is retired faculty, alum, staff, if one out of every 10 residents is wearing the sweatshirt and screaming at the TV in the pub on Saturdays, you know, for the football game or basketball, that's going to bring the culture. And that's really going to be a missing link if you don't have that. So those five criteria really can be a foundation. Now, when I remember talking to Lindsay, and she told me flat out when they were looking at Mirabella, they literally sat down with those five criteria and built to it. And I mean, they have a very, very successful community, as we see others are doing as well.
That's great. Now, I think the first one was it should be proximate or you know, near campus.
Yes.
And I know there are some that are right on campus. How close does a community need to be, do you think? Or what's the furthest away, you know, blocks or a mile or two?
Well, you know,
how can they actually consider themselves such?
Well, one thing I like to tell university presidents when I meet with them, and I'll meet with the board, I'll say, look, the one thing 80-year-olds and 20-year-olds have in common is none of them have cars. So number one. Number two, we all went to college. When you were at college, even if you lived off campus or in the dorms, right? But once you got outside of about a mile of that campus, once you got outside that bubble, that culture, that university town center, right? We all knew that, you know, there was a certain point where if you lived too far off of campus, from campus, you didn't feel like you were part of the campus. And again, that cultural connection is huge. It's huge.
Absolutely.
It's not just emotional. It's real. And so I like to see them within a mile. Now, I've seen a few that stretch it a little bit, but they have transportation, right? I mean, some of these universities have massive transits. Some of them have campuses that are 4 miles apart. They have multiple campuses. Well, if you've got a shuttle bus running back and forth and it's free, students can hop on, residents can hop on. So there's ways around it. But if you get too far, really, once you get past 3, 4, 5 miles, I mean, there's one in this country that's actually 25 miles from the campus. And other than using the name of the university mascot, I mean, really, you're 25 miles away. What do you really have to do with that campus?
Sure, sure. It probably is more a marketing opportunity to the alumni than really anything else.
It is. But I remember calling them one day and just saying, hey, you know, if I live there, can I get tickets to the football game? No. Can I get tickets to the basketball game? No. Performing arts? No. We're kind of far away. Well, you've lost those connections.
Yep. Makes sense. Now, some of these communities are directly affiliated with the universities or the colleges, while others, you know, are simply close by.
Yes.
What's the ideal level of university involvement?
It's interesting because some of the ones that have developed organically, there's one called the Pillars at Prospect Park, right up, University of Minnesota. I just discovered them a couple weeks ago. They weren't built in connection with the university, but they have a person there who's kind of a dean of residents, and they work really hard at this. They're only about a mile away. And I mean, they might as well have been built with the university, because by the time they settled, everybody there went to the University of Minnesota and all that. So it really depends on the commitment. I think that the proximity matters. And then I think it's the commitment. And then, you know, the ones that are frankly kind of on our website, we have about 85 of these, by the way. But some of them, frankly, very, very loosely connected. If they have some mention on their website, they qualify to be on the site. But we tell our visitors to our website, contact them, really narrow this down and make sure it's what you want. Some of them are, frankly, just kind of a handshake. Some of them are really, really partnered.
That's fascinating. Yeah, and my wife, son, and I are all Golden Gophers, so I'll have to check out that community at the University of Minnesota.
I really have enjoyed getting to know the folks at this community.
That's terrific. So what are some of the biggest challenges in establishing a university retirement community and other common roadblocks that organizations and universities face?
Well, now this may be the most important question. If you're a university person listening to this or senior living person listening, look, you can't find a bigger odd couple than universities that are big, bureaucratic, slow-moving entities focused on 20 in the bubble of 20-year-olds and fast-paced, investor-driven senior living providers focused on 80. You can't find two organizations more different. And problems can happen if you do not understand the relationship you're getting into. You know, if you just think this is a slam dunk and easy to do and we'll build it and they will come, that's not how it works. They have to understand their roles. They speak two completely different languages. They are on two completely different timelines. I like to joke that somehow I ended up being fluent in both languages. And sometimes I feel like the UN translator in these meetings, trying to just translate between these parties. Well, this is how it works. They have to understand their roles and not step on each other's toes. And they have to get that in place fairly quickly, structure it very tightly. The biggest issue for universities is, ironically, they're the ones who need the most education because they're not country clubs. And, you know, for the retired faculty, you know, they're senior living organizations. Mm-hmm. And then you need to have the senior living providers who understand how to access the university without being driven nuts by all the bureaucracy. So that's what we work on.
Interesting. So have you seen, and I'm not certainly going to ask you to name names either on either side, the community or the university, but where it's broken down and hasn't moved forward. I'm sure that there have been those scenarios, but some of the impasses?
Yeah,
again, not naming names.
Not going to name the school, but it was actually a pretty major unit. And by the way, they've gotten over it now. But I remember visiting them about 15 years ago. And they had built near campus, leased land, done all of that. But nobody had paid any attention beyond, here's a land lease and we built something. And I visited them and there were no students. Nowhere. I said, do you have a single student in this community? No. Well, why not? Well, you know, it's just the faculty were driving us nuts with all these internships and trying to put people in here. And well, they didn't structure it. The university didn't want to talk to them because after they opened, this is true. The university president was getting phone calls from some of the residents complaining about the food in the community. So, you know, I mean, what's he supposed to do with that? What happened was, is very quickly, a few years in, they just stopped talking to each other. And there were no alums living there, no faculty, and they might as well have built a million miles away. Now, in fairness to them, they went to work on that. Frankly, I kind of read them the Riot Act and said, you're wasting this. But if you look at them today, they really fixed all of it. but they had to go back and retroactively understand the things I talked about a minute ago. How do we talk to each other? How do we work together? How do we not step on each other's toes?
Sure, sure. So any other missteps or pitfalls where a university retirement community didn't function or launch as planned? Any other things to watch out for?
I think, again, on the university side, they don't know our business, senior living. There was a famous example many years ago, Eckerd College down near St. Petersburg. Well, you know, in our business, everybody puts in a proposal. Everybody has a glossy four-color brochure at those times. And they basically partnered with a developer that everybody in my business knew had no idea what they were doing, but their brochure looked nice. And so Eckerd didn't know this. And the project went bankrupt before it even opened. And they lost millions of dollars on their endowment, which they had put up to basically guarantee it. And it was a disaster. LaSalle Village up at LaSalle University survived. They're doing great. But they also partnered with a company. I remember the company I worked at the time. We were waiting for them to go out of business so we could buy their properties. But they aligned with them. And sure enough, halfway into the construction, they disappeared. And LaSalle ended up having to finish the project. Now, to their credit, they did a terrific job basically saving it, but I would not recommend that any university do that. So again, it's really working with universities. You need to understand our business. You need to work with the providers who really we know are good, and it's not just about their website or their brochure.
Sure, sure. So we've talked about, you know, some of the pitfalls on the administrative side. What role do faculty and students play in integrating, you know, the residents into campus life and really ultimately making all of this successful?
Well, if you manage it well, like Lindsay does, like some of the other ones do, obviously having young people in the community is crucial. Now, what you can't do is let them overrun it. You know, I was faculty. I helped. Nothing a faculty person loves better than being assigned an internship course, because basically you just got 15 weeks of not having to teach a single class and getting credit for it. And you're basically dumping your students on somebody else. Now, you know, you're supposed to be paying attention. But what you got to be careful with on the community side is a lot of these faculty would love nothing better than to drop 10, 15 students on you. Look, it's their home. I tell them all the time, this isn't a laboratory. It's their home. And we want to have students in there that can have some synergy and positive effect and learn. And we want to get them into the aging services field. But you've got to limit it, and you've got to really tightly manage that. So they can play a huge role if they're willing to work with you and not overwhelm you. But they can also, you know, get, frankly, a little out of control if you don't manage it.
Sure, sure. So any specific programs or initiatives that you've seen work particularly well in fostering that engagement between the seniors, the residents of the community, and the students?
I mean, generally speaking, there's certain buckets that I see work every time. Anything to do with visual performing arts, anything to do with athletics. And it doesn't have to be Division I, by the way. The Spires of Barrett College is a little Division III school. And the residents will go to every women's softball game, every tennis match.
That's great.
And I mean, it's great. This is, you know, these are kids who would have had nobody in the stands other than maybe a few parents and friends. And because of that, here they are, this little Division III school, and they have people, fan clubs showing up. But I mean, I think the residents will take advantage of certain things if you work it out. They love visual performing arts. They love music. They love the sports. They love lifelong learning. And so if you have a lifelong learning institute, they will gravitate to that. So you see this repeatedly. And when I consult with universities, I look for these things. I actually have a 21-point rubric. I score them before I even show up, and I'll show them how they score and what they're missing. And so they can work on that.
Sure. Now, you were just talking about the older adults who are drawn to lifelong learning and sports and arts and other things. Broadly, what types of older adults are drawn to university retirement communities? Obviously there's the retired faculty, as you mentioned, at Indiana University, but more broadly, who?
Well, I think it's understanding the boomers. You know, people, these are not the traditional audience, right? I'm a boomer, by the way, right? So, but we know about boomers, and all the studies have shown this over and over and over again. It comes down to three things. They want active, they want intellectually stimulating, and they want intergenerational retirement environments. They do not want to live on what I call an elderly island. Doesn't matter how nice it is. Well, think about what I just described. Active, intellectually stimulating, intergenerational. I just described a college campus. And number one. Number two, boomers are the most highly educated retirement demographic in history. Almost a third of us went to have a bachelor's degree or higher. 60% of us have some college. So this is what we're used to. And we're really not looking to retire to a rocking chair on the porch and watch the sun go up and down, which we watched our parents do. And as it turns out, either they told us or we learned from watching them is actually extraordinarily unhealthy.
Sure. Yep. Interesting. So I did my undergraduate work at the University of North Dakota. I was involved in Greek life, the student newspaper, student government, you know, other kinds of clubs. I remain pretty active, you know, on campus. And we often hear that university retirement community members, residents have access to all the things on the college campus that a typical student does. Do you see residents getting involved in, you know, traditional student organizations, Greek life, those sorts of things? You know, and how are they embraced? Are they able to, you know, if they're not a full-time student?
Yeah. I'm sure, first of all, that's a great question. I haven't really looked at, I'm sure it's happening. And I'm sure if I called up five of my friends at some of these right now, they'd say, of course we're doing that. I don't have an example off the top of my head because I don't think it's a formal thing that I've seen. But there's absolutely zero chance that you don't have a bunch of former sorority sisters or fraternity brothers living in these communities who aren't finding a way to be engaged. So actually, thanks to your question, I'm probably going to now call up about five friends in the next day or so and ask them what that's all about.
Sure. Well, you know, even if it's, you know, whether it is Greek life as an alumnus or interest groups or that sort of thing, I can see, you know, there being a lot of value they could bring to some of these groups and organizations.
Yeah. I mean, look, the alumni associations are there. I mean, they're a primary source of referrals, frankly. That's target number one. There are also a lot of universities, not all, but a lot of universities have a retired faculty association. And these are folks who have spent their entire adult life at this campus. And they don't want to leave. So I also see where you have a retired faculty association. Sometimes they're the ones who frankly contact me and say, can you come out and convince our university president to do this? So those are two organizations that do exist. And then the Lifelong Learning Institutes. You know, when you have a what's called like an Osher, Bernard Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, I think there's 400 of them funded around the country. But when you've got 1,000 members in that, and they're coming to your campus to take, you know, these lifelong learning courses in some building off to the side of campus. I mean, they're right there. And there's nothing easier than them living on campus and getting off the elevator and going to the classroom that you built in that community just for them.
Great point. So you mentioned Ollie or the you know, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute. Studies show that lifelong learning can improve cognitive health. Have you seen evidence that university retirement communities contribute to better aging outcomes?
I do, and I actually have this theory that they may actually reverse aging. Now, I know that's like, holy smokes, what's he talking about? But there's two studies that we know of. Many years ago, Ellen Langer, who's a psychologist at Harvard, did a study. She wrote a book called Counterclockwise, and this is a very famous bestseller. And what she did is she took a group of seven or eight men in their 70s to what was an old motel or something for 1 week. But she didn't tell them in advance that once they got there, everything was going to be set back 20 years. They wouldn't be allowed to talk. So they're back to their early 50s, right? Or in their 50s. And they weren't allowed to talk about anything that happened after that. All the TV shows were old TV shows, the magazines, the books, everything in the environment for 1 week. Took them back 20 years. At the end of the week, they literally grew younger. Their dexterity improved, their vision improved, their balance improved, their hearing improved. One of them came in with a cane. At the end of the week, they were having a touch football game in the front yard. And what she saw was is this idea that you could actually be as young as you feel. And it's actually true. And so that was a very famous study. Now, I talked to Ellen a few years ago, and I said, you know, there's also this thing called the reminiscence bump. And the reminiscence bump says that your most powerful memories are actually formed between the ages of about 18 and 25. Why? Well, because your brain's at maximum function. You're experiencing all of life's firsts, right? Your first love, your first car, your first job, whatever. Very powerful memories. And including, guess what? Going to college, which is why we wear that gosh darn sweatshirt for 50 years. There's a reason, because we feel so strongly about that. And what I said to Ellen was, is what if you combine the reminiscence bump with the counterclockwise effect? And I called it the counterclockwise bump. I said, what if you instead of taking them back 20 years, you took them back 50 to the reminiscence bump, which, as you can see where I'm going with this, is literally what a URC does. And she said, I think you're absolutely right. And so I think that this is a study we need to do. I've been talking about it. If there's any researchers on here, call me. But I'm fairly convinced that based on her study and what we know about the reminiscence bump, we might actually show that these folks, first of all, definitely stay healthier in these environments. So if you take them off an elderly island, put them in an intergenerational environment like a college campus, they're going to be better. But I'm curious as to whether or not it may actually slow, if not reverse, some of the elements of aging.
Sure. Now, that's fascinating. So can you share any specific stories or testimonials from residents that illustrate the impact? You mentioned the the study with the the bump, but any other specific stories that you have gleaned?
Mirabella has a great program called Artists in Residence. And you may have talked to Lindsay about this. I think they have three or four PhD music students getting their doctorate in music, and they get to live in the community for free. But in exchange for that, they have to basically do a performance, play at dinner or something, right? Put on a little music or somehow engage with the residents. And what happened was, is it became so popular, residents would come up and they would say, you know, I was in band in high school. I played the clarinet. I used to play the trumpet. And they started forming a resident orchestra. They did this at Oberlin too, by the way, Oberlin College, Kendall at Oberlin years ago. Oberlin is a music school, but you can walk into Kendall and Oberlin and there'll be a little orchestra playing in the lobby that's half residents and half students. So those kinds of things, when you see them, are just terrific. I also see where you have things where you have mentorship programs. The Pines at Davidson is a great community where incoming freshmen can be lined up. Say you want to study engineering. Well, they might partner you with a resident in the community who's a retired engineer. And while you live there, you can pick their brains. You can talk to them. So these kinds of things are really, really where you see these universities, URCs, really doing a great job.
Sure. So who benefits more, do you think? And I realize it's a mutually beneficial relationship, but those are always the best kinds. But is it the retirement community itself or the university that benefits more? Is it the students or the residents?
Well, I mean, done right, it's what I call, and again, I'm going back to my old strategic planning days. This is a very rare triple win scenario. You don't see this in business strategy, where there are three parties and all of them can win. Obviously, the residents can win for the reasons I just discussed. The universities can win, and it's not just about declining enrollment. It's about the strategic opportunity here to take a piece of land you were doing nothing with and really breaking down those barriers to aging. The students win because we are living in an aging world, right? I mean, by 2030, there's going to be more people over the age of 65 than under the age of 18 for the first time in human history, 300,000 years of human history. So universities, and I tell if you have a mission to serve the community, you might want to look out the window because we have an aging population and your students, that's where the jobs are, and that's the world they're going to be living in. So they win. And then the senior living providers win because, frankly, this is what people want. You know, and I've said to people in my industry, we need to stop building what we want to build. We need to start building what our retirees actually want.
Well said.
This is what they want.
Hmm. So if a university is considering launching a university retirement community, what's the single most important piece of advice that you would give them?
Get up, do your homework. Actually, I've said to chancellors, provosts, VP presidents, I said, the first thing I'm doing is I'm giving you homework. These are complicated. This is not something you just sounds like fun. It's hard work and you need to do your homework and you need to get up to speed. Now, I have a presentation I do. I've done this for a lot of, it's kind of an initial, I call it an initial go, no-go assessment. And I lay out my 21-point score, of course. I give them the whole history, the background, a lot of the things we're talking about. But when we get all done, I'm trying to position them to decide, is this something you really want to do? Because you might have even scored really high on the rubric, but you might decide this isn't really what you want. So just understand, and or maybe you were really, really excited about it, but your rubric score, frankly, is so low, this is not a strategic opportunity for you. And before you jump into it and spend end up like Eckerd College and losing millions of dollars and years of time, you know, let me try to save you from this. Now, if it is a go, I can also help them accelerate it, because the faster you get educated on this, look, on the senior living side, we're talking, you know, millions and millions of dollars every year you wait. I mean, let's get going. Some of these schools take 8, 10, 12 years to decide. Well, a lot of the top senior living providers have said to me, Andy, I don't have 10 years to wait on this. You know, so they'd love to get into it, but the schools need to get going. So I really think it's educating the schools. Now, I can work with the senior living provider once that's done. But if the school isn't committed to doing it, what's the point in bringing in a top provider?
Absolutely. So educating the educators.
Yes.
So shifting gears just a little bit here. This is a question I like to ask every Roundtable Talk guest. What are you looking forward to as you age?
Staying engaged. Two-word answer, I guess. Just never stop moving. And I've been in the business for many years. I've been an operator. I've run communities. And what you see is when people stop being engaged, whether it's physically, cognitively, socially, spiritually, you know, that's when you begin to see the acceleration of aging. So I would just say to anyone, just stay engaged. However you define engagement, just stay engaged.
That's wonderful. Yeah. And that certainly is a common theme that I'm sure goes through a lot of your work with the university retirement communities.
Yeah. Well, I think you and I talked about this a few weeks ago, but this whole website is actually my retirement hobby.
There you go.
I actually retired from operations and mostly from teaching a year ago and started this the first day of my retirement. I bought the URL for the website. So the running joke between my wife and I is this is my retirement hobby.
That's wonderful. So, you know, obviously this is a focal point for you now as you're shifting in your life stage. But, you know, you've been in senior living for decades beyond just the university retirement communities. What are some of the biggest shifts broadly that you've seen in the field over the years?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest shift, and everyone would agree, is over, you know, I've been 35 years now, is just moving away from this idea that we're not a nursing home to actually thinking about what people want.
Are we achieving it?
Yeah, by evolving, by learning. You know, we had this kind of cookie cutter. Then we still, to some extent, it's kind of a cookie cutter model where, you know, you could still take the sign down in front of a lot of communities, put up a new one, and no one would. It's like Hilton, Sheraton, Marriott. I mean, you could swap the signs, nobody would notice. But we're seeing more the need to differentiate. And we're seeing these niche, what I call affinity communities, because there's 80 million baby boomers. I mean, we invented 32 flavors of ice cream, for goodness sakes. So we're not going to settle for vanilla. You know, you got 80 million people. There's enough people who like mint chocolate chip and enough people who like, I don't know, butter pecan to put both products on the shelf. And one of the things I've said over the years is, look for the niches. And I did this also before even university retirement communities. I traveled around. I found RV assisted living communities. I found senior living communities focused on different cultures, Asian American cultures, right? Indian American cultures. If you name a niche, people will go to it. There was a group of nudists down in Florida years ago wanted to build a nudist colony for nudists. And my point was, how many people do you need to fill it? I talked to some cruise ship directors years ago. Could we build a cruise ship and fill it with retirees? Well, how many does a ship hold? About 400. Well, we've got 80 million in the United States. Of course you could. So this is now what happens with URCs is I think they just happen to be the most popular niche because they really meet check a lot of the boxes for everybody.
Sure.
But that's
sure.
Where we need to go as an industry.
Makes perfect sense. So how have expectations from the older adults changed in terms of housing services? Lifestyle. What have you seen there? I know you referenced the boomers being the big wave right now, obviously.
I think the same thing. They don't want vanilla chocolate strawberry, right? They don't want, active adult, assisted living, life plan community. They want flavors. This isn't about separating themselves out or, you know, I have to be in this specialty group, but they want to have these common interests. Or even LGBTQ plus communities, right? I mean, there are populations where they're going to gather anyway. So why don't you let them gather where they want to be? And I think that's what this next generation is. Look, we just want more than it's not a nursing home. That was actually fine when really the only other choice was a nursing home. And we had millions of seniors who lived in a nursing home who did not need to be there. And we all agreed with that. And we did a great job in our industry addressing that. But we need to take that next step now. I like to share at conferences, I talk about how if you go back 40 years, nobody would say anybody in the room, I would pay $4 for a cup of coffee, right? But here we are all these years later, and we're always complaining about how we only have about 5% market penetration for senior living. And what I said was, is, well, because we're not building what they want, because you build a URC and all of a sudden it's 95% pre-sold a year before it opens or 6 months before it opens. So, you know, I mean, Howard Schultz said, you know what, people pay $4 for a cup of coffee. You just have to stop making crappy coffee. Give people what they want. And so I think that's what we're seeing with URCs. I think my industry is beginning to realize we just need to meet people where they want to be at. And you'd be surprised what they're willing to, how far they're willing to move. And real quick, you know, the typical primary service area for a life plan community is what, 10, 15 miles, maybe 20?
If that, yeah.
You open a URC, there are people living at Mirabella at ASU who moved 1,000 miles. I met people at the spires of Berry College outside of Rome, Georgia, a little 900 student school outside of Rome, Georgia, who had moved from California to be there. So look at the power of putting the right product on the shelf.
Now, let me ask you, in those instances, you know, particularly with the small school at Spire College, were they alumni or were they just really drawn in by the experience?
I had a terrific chat with a couple of residents there who had moved long distances. I said, why you moved to Rome, Georgia? And they said, we were looking for a university retirement community, and we know that the southern climate's good. Hmm. And they had one.
So it ticked a few of the boxes they were looking for.
Are you happy here? We love it. We go to the tennis matches. They basically become de facto alums. Now, it would have been nice if their alma mater had one.
Sure. No, that's great. So are there other trends that you see shaping the future of senior living broadly?
Well, I mean, I was big into technology for many years. I called it Nana technology, as in technology for your grandma. But again, it was strategic. We don't have enough workers. I said this 15 years ago, we had a worker shortage, and we're not going to have enough workers. So we need to automate. And this is all about not just AI, but robotics and lots of other things. But I did spend a number of years where I would put out a list when I was at George Mason University every year of the top 10 nanotechnologies that I saw. I think we need more technology. We need to invest heavily in it. We need to quit kidding ourselves that employees are going to magically appear. They're not. We can talk about revising our immigration system. We should, for legal immigration. We need workers. We're going to compete with the whole world for that. But even with that, you know, we're probably not going to have enough people. So look, my point is you can build all the Starbucks you want, but I mean, somebody's got to pour the coffee and mispronounce your name. And so you have to have those people.
So are there any technologies, one or two, that you see that are you think truly game-changing?
Yeah, I've tried to focus people, and I did some consulting on this years ago before I retired and focused on you. But I did, what I would focus these companies on, because they would call me, is we need things that eliminate steps. So think about it. You know, how many steps does a nurse's aide have to take in a day? A food service worker, a hospitality worker, a housekeeping staff, so environmental services. So think about removing steps. So for example, in one community I was working with, we put in these robotic servers in the dining room. Well, yeah, because, you know, the wait staff, the server staff spend most of their time going back and forth to the kitchen when they could be going table to table, either taking an order, plating an order, or picking it up and putting it on the robot. Let the robot go back and forth. I've put robotic vacuum cleaners. Look at miles and miles of hallways, miles and miles of hall. How many hours does a person spend pushing a vacuum cleaner when you could have basically a little mini Zamboni vacuum cleaner? Vacuum the hallways. So these are the kinds of things. Even with the nurse's aides, why are they going down to the room to check on certain things when that could have been automatically through sensors, sure, or whatever? They could have been notified of alerts, or have been more efficient in how they go about their work.
Interesting. Because when you were saying steps, at first I wasn't sure if you meant literal steps, walking, or if literal you meant steps. Like steps in a process. but I would imagine it could help in, you know, steps in a process where it might automate, you know, certain things to help, focus on other.
I mean, that, you know, that's where information technology comes in, or even AI, where predictive analytics, where you can predict what someone's going to fall or address that before they fall. So yeah, there's a lot of IT in there as well.
Sure. Interesting. So you referenced workforce and, we've all seen that certainly through and coming out of the pandemic that it's a major challenge. It's been talked about at Leading Edge and other conferences for years, but we're feeling the effects of it now. What strategies do you see as most effective in recruiting and retaining talent?
Well, I mean, again, I think you have to look at your buckets. I like to put things in buckets. But I mean, you got your salaried workers, right? Your executive directors, your department heads. You've got your hourly workers. I mean, on the hourly side, we don't have enough people. I really think that, you know, I live in Washington, D.C., but I'm not going to get into the politics of this. But it's just math. I mean, I might not know about policy, but I know math. We're mathematically eliminated. So we need to figure out how to bring people into this country who will do the hourly work in environmental services, in dining, in AIDS. And while we automate, by the way, but it's got to be that mix. And then on the professional side, you know, what I did at George Mason 25 years ago, we had to have academic curricula in senior living. You know, they're not nursing homes. They're not hotels. And it was very frustrating 25 years ago when I worked with a company. I was one of the founding executives, but we went from 0 to 70 communities in 5 years, either through development or acquisition. Well, I mean, I was one of the people who was very frustrated because you're looking to hire someone to be the executive director of this building you spent $30 million on, and you spend the first half hour of the interview explaining what assisted living is. It just didn't make sense. So that's where the academic curricula came in. Can you bring young people into the field? Can you bring people who are career changers into the field, but educate them? Don't just throw them in there. You know, we would hire nursing home administrators, wonderful people, hardworking people. But honestly, 3 months later, the place looked like a nursing home, right? And then we would hire hotel people, wonderful people, hardworking people. They had no idea how to deal with Alzheimer's or a lot of these health communicate with doctors or pharmacies, pharmacists, rehab. So, you know, we needed to have a curricula to bring people in at that level while we fill in the hourly level as well.
Sure. And, you know, that's an interesting concept, just the notion of cross-training, that if somebody starts out as a nursing home administrator, that's going to be their orientation or their comfort zone. And same thing with hospitality or what have you.
Well, yeah. And I mean, I'm very proud of what we did at Mason. I mean, I left there a few years ago, but I mean, the program still runs. We put hundreds and hundreds of young people into the field, some of whom email me now, you know, they're vice presidents. One of them owns his own community. You know, I mean, they're very successful executives. They're at the corporate level and they love their career path, about which they never would have known if the curricula wasn't available.
That has to be really rewarding.
It's great to hear from them and they send me pictures of their kids and everything else. And that's then I great. Start to feel a little old.
Of course, it always does age you, doesn't it?
Yes.
So you just referenced it, but you created the first in the nation concentration in senior living administration at George Mason University in 2001. So 24 years ago or thereabouts. What inspired you to create the program? What gap in the field were you trying to fill?
Well, I mean, I think the thing I talked about a minute ago, I was just very frustrated. I mean, it was so obvious that we needed to train people in this new, you know, it's like you go to medical school where you could be a neurologist or a cardiologist, but they're two different things, right? You could be a surgeon. They're different things. And we didn't have a path for them to come into this, number one. Number two, my company was based in Northern Virginia, so it's Sunrise Senior Living. And actually, all credit should go to Terry Clausen, who with her husband, Paul Clausen, founded Sunrise Senior Living. And she was an alum of George Mason and on the board of visitors. And long story short, my chairman was in a meeting with her where apparently he said, she sounds just like you. She keeps saying, why isn't there a program for this? And so I went up to George Mason, met with Terry, a bunch of the faculty. And Terry said, look, we'll put up some money from Sunrise, which they did. But we need somebody to put this all together. And basically they said, would you be willing to commit 3-5 years to this? I thought it was important. I said, sure. I ended up staying 15 years. But it was a very successful program. Very proud of it.
tremendous. So can you walk us through some of the core curriculum? What key skills do students gain from this program?
Yeah, and again, if there's anyone at a university on here, hopefully this part is helpful. Some things that we did. First of all, we placed it in the health administration major. Some of the other programs have been in place in hospitality schools. Now, there's no right or wrong, but at the end of the day, senior living is a massive part of the healthcare sector. It just is, let alone that we deliver a lot of healthcare services. But I mean, you're going to spend your career working with hospitals, with doctors, with rehab, with pharmacies. You know, you need to understand the healthcare system, how it works, how it's reimbursed, the whole thing. Obviously, even inside your walls, there's a lot of healthcare elements, memory care, things like that. So we placed it. They had got a degree and still do, a bachelor's degree in healthcare administration. So that's foundational. Healthcare finance, healthcare strategic planning, the courses I taught, healthcare policy, health, right? All of these things. So they have a solid understanding of that, but then their concentration, just like if you go to medical school and decide to be a cardiologist, their concentration was senior living. And then we had very specific courses, an entire semester just in operations, every department, every function for 15 weeks, an entire semester, the first ever course, full semester course in senior living sales and marketing. Well, nursing homes don't do sales and marketing. I mean, you know, it's a whole different thing. So entire 15, 16 weeks in just sales and marketing, how to manage your leads, your conversion rates, how to manage your budget, where to spend your money. But then we also had an entire course in Alzheimer's disease and memory care. I mean, because it's there. So you might want to understand it. So we had a curriculum that allowed them to go through this. Now, we didn't ignore hospitality. I actually created the first ever senior living internships with Disney World in Florida. And we got a lot of credit for that. We didn't say hospitality is not important. We actually sent our students for an entire semester to the best hospitality provider in the world. And Disney loved it. In fact, they tried to steal every single one of them because they were so good at it. Because they had that compassion and empathy. They frankly were outperforming some of the hotel management majors. But we tried to bring this all together so that by the time they went out in the field or did their internship, you know, they understood all of these foundational things about what they were getting into for the rest of their lives.
Sure, sure. So you mentioned that the students were outperforming some of the others in different types of programs. Who is the ideal student for this program? Are they industry veterans looking to advance, newcomers seeking to break into the field, or do they just have something innate? What do you look for? What makes them successful?
So we found two things. At the graduate level, it's career changers. A lot of people whose moms or dads were in assisted living, and they said, you know, this is kind of really interesting. I could see myself doing this. School teachers, by the way, make great, if they come through and learn, they actually, because they were used to dealing with parents and managing a lot of things at once. At the undergraduate level, just young people who are realizing that the world is aging. You know, a lot of the best high school kids, honor society and all that, they have to do volunteer work. And where do they volunteer? The assisted living community. So they spent a little time in high school around seniors and discovered this is kind of neat and naturally gravitate towards, you know, I could see myself doing this for the rest of my, maybe, it's, you know, I used to tell my students at Mason, you know, you can study IT, but we can outsource those jobs. We're not going to outsource 80 million seniors. So they also see the opportunities, but also their own personal kind of sense of what they want. This youngest generation now, they're very mission oriented. You know, they grew up in 9/11. They grew up in a different world where they really want to contribute and give back.
Sure. Interesting. Now, you founded this program back in 2001.
Yes.
And I know UMBC has a program, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, with the Erickson School. There are gerontology programs out there. But is a focus on senior living still fairly rare, or are you seeing more popping up around the country?
It's very rare. First of all, big fan of the UMBC program, but it is more of a degree in aging services management. Again, our little tweak was, is I only taught seniors. I would have people call me and say, if I do this, can I get my nursing home license? And I would say, no, but you can work in senior living. Oh, and by the way, there are 30,000 senior living communities and only 15,000 nursing homes. So, in reality, they probably could get their license. But my point was, I wasn't teaching nursing home administration. I wasn't teaching gerontology per se. although the curriculum included electives in aging in our gerontology courses. So I think that was the difference for us. Some of the other schools are kind of focusing on senior living. Again, they've kind of placed it in the hospitality school. Not saying that's wrong, but they need to think about how they're going to backfill that knowledge of healthcare. Because at the end of the day, what we do is not only healthcare, but a huge, huge part of the healthcare system. You're going to be working with all of these healthcare organizations, and you can't go into it having no idea. I was a hospital CEO before I got to senior living. Listen, it's also complicated. So you better understand these vertically integrated healthcare systems and how the whole healthcare system in this country works.
Interesting. So you know, we've had a great conversation. Really appreciate your time today, but I have one last question, and I ask every guest this. What have you learned? You mentioned you're a boomer. What have you learned that you wish you could have told your younger self?
So it's great because I actually do tell my students this. I tell them, you know, if I were your age again, and I usually do this in the last lecture of the semester, but I say, you know, think about, and particularly in my strategic planning courses, one of the things we learned is that status quo is never a long-term strategy for success. If you don't change you in business, you eventually go away. Look what we talked about with senior living and changing. And so what I've said to them is never be afraid to keep moving forward. And don't you don't have to be patient. If there's something you want to pursue, if I went back to my younger self, I would have told myself, frankly, to not be, frankly, as patient and willing to tolerate the status quo just because I worked in an organization that was happy with the status quo. And what you need to think about is if you're not happy with the status quo, go to work for somebody who also isn't happy with the status quo. So look at the things like creating the curricula or the URC model or nanotechnology, or I was really into memory care design for many years. All of those things were about changing the status quo. And so what I say to my students is if I could go up and tell myself, I would have started earlier on that. I wouldn't have been so patient about just accepting things the way they were. If you think it should change, it could be better. Go make it better. Because as it turns out in business and in life, moving forward is always doing the right thing for your customers or yourself is always the right thing to do.
Well said. That's great. Well, Andrew Carl, thank you so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it. And you know, you're doing great work with universityretirementcommunities.com. And I'd also like to thank our producer, Dave Schaffner, our engineer, Matt Campbell, and we'll look forward to seeing you the next time on Varsity's Roundtable Talk.
Well,
thanks again.
Great questions. Thank you so much.
Take care and have a good rest of the day.
Okay.